Welcome, welcome. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for coming back if you've been here one of the other 2 days as well. Come on in. There's plenty of seats over on this side. It doesn't work. You can come on through. It's fine. Oh, okay.
Or coffee.
I hope this ventilation is good enough because we're doing the most we can do. Can you hear me all right? How many of you, this is your first day with me at these sessions? Welcome, so glad you're here. Welcome back to the rest of you. I was worried, I said to Allison last night, I'm like, oh my gosh, I threw so many slides and text heavy bits of information at these folks. Will anybody come back today? So thank you for, today is gonna be a much better pace. I think, and I think you'll, oh, I forgot to get my little clicker, but that doesn't matter. For those of you who are here today, I just want you to know the first day was some introductions. Yesterday we did a lot of history and explaining why history matters. Today, I'm very excited because I'm going to lay out a map from Janet Helms that helps us kind of understand more white identity and really important options. So if you've been feeling a little distressed or stuck in what do I do with the weight of all of this, I hope today you start to feel like, aha, there's some constructive, creative ways to go here. And then tomorrow, I'm going to quickly define racism in a couple of different ways and move then to watching a 25-minute video on housing and structural racism. Okay? And then our last day together, we'll be really looking at mapping concrete steps that we can take, strategies in our respective homes and spheres of influence, so that you can start to think, how can my life take shape beyond Holden? So that's how we're going to be moving forward in these next sessions. And today is really then white identity formation. We've done some of the malformation, but I want to explain a little bit more about that, and then possibilities for reformation, since we are, many of us here, Lutheran. We have to use these Lutheran terminology. So, truly welcome. So, first of all, before we get into the meat of today, or the heart of today, I want to come back over and make a correction, because I was so in such a lather yesterday talking about so much history that I misstated something. And I want to respond more fully to you, Fred, because you brought up something that I was so pressed for time, I felt like I didn't handle it well. So a little bit of the history from yesterday. December 26, 1862, President Lincoln orders the largest mass execution in U.S. history. It was not 150. The article, when it was written, was 150 years ago, and somehow my brain just had an aneurysm or something for a minute, and I just used that number. It was that 38 Lakota were hanged in Mankato, Minnesota. And the article from The Nation, which story came from, makes the comparison, and this is as far as I got yesterday, that I didn't give enough context. What were the Lakota found guilty of? They had killed 490 white settlers, including women and children, in the previous August at the Santee Sioux Uprising. What the article from The Nation, the contrast that The Nation wants us to consider, is that Lincoln ordered this mass hanging, which contrasts quite significantly with how we treated Confederate soldiers after the end of the Civil War. In that case of the Civil War, he did not order the execution of any officers or generals, even though they had killed more than 400,000 Union soldiers. The only Confederate executed was the commander of a prison for what we would call crimes against humanity, for mistreatment of people who were prisoners of war. Now, war is ugly. Oftentimes, there are civilian casualties, and there are people caught in the crossfire, and there are tactics that are used that target non-combatants as well, and civilians. So certainly, we can say that if the Lakota attacked white settlers, including women and children, that we might have human rights concerns about that. But I also think it's important to put those kinds of uprisings and attacks into the perspective of the larger project that was colonialization. It was not a fair fight. in terms of the military might that colonial settlers were able to have behind them, in terms of the smallpox infections, also bringing in whiskey and other things. I mean, we use a whole lot of strategies as well to weaken and overpower indigenous communities. So just to say a little bit more about that, in 1862, Minnesota was a new frontier state where white settlers were pushing out the Dakota Indians. A series of broken peace treaties culminated in the failure of the United States that summer to deliver promised food and supplies to these Indians, which had been promised to them as partial payment for giving up their lands to whites. One local trader, Andrew Mirek, said of the Indians' plight, "Well, if they're hungry, then let them eat the grass." So then the Dakota leader, Little Crow, led his enraged and starving tribe in a series of attacks on frontier settlements. The U.S.-Dakota War did not, if you can consider it a war fully, did not last long. After 6 weeks, Henry Hastings Sibley, the first governor of Minnesota and the leader of the state militia, captured 2,000 Dakota and a military, Lakota, that's a typo, sorry, and a military court sentenced 303 to death. Now, what Lincoln did from there is important as well. Lincoln, however, he didn't agree with General John Pope, who was sent out to put down a Sioux uprising in southern Minnesota, and who said that, and what Pope said was that it's my duty, it's my purpose, utterly to exterminate the Sioux if I have the power to do so. Lincoln, in contrast, carefully reviewed the trial records, and he, Lincoln, found a lack of evidence at most of the tribunals. So he commuted the sentence of 265 of the Lakota Indians, which was politically unpopular. So the 265 who were not then hung that day on December 26th, they were either fully pardoned or they died in prison. Lincoln and Congress subsequently removed the Sioux and the Winnebago. The Winnebago had nothing to do with that uprising, from all of their lands in Minnesota. So that's a bit more of the historical picture. And I want to honor and acknowledge that the history that I gave yesterday, both in terms of slavery and Christian, white Christian justifications of it, and in terms of the treatment of the Lakota, is definitely incomplete. And certainly I have not at all mentioned anything about Japanese immigrants, Chinese immigrants, Japanese internment camps. I mean, I really recognize I've given you just a few snapshots that are partial and incomplete. And what I would say is that the more that we can do history really rooted in where we live and work, where the more we can map our own geographies, our towns, states, neighborhoods, the deeper it is and the better it is. So tomorrow's film that we're going to watch is a lot about my hometown of Chicago, using that as a lens to understand the larger national issue of housing discrimination and the federal policies that have made that possible. So I gave you kind of a bird's eye view, and it is better when we can do more and more local and specific things. But I really did want to fill in a bit more of that context because I felt like I did not do it justice yesterday. If you're interested in knowing more about some of these really important histories in relations between white settlers and the Native American tribes, I'm from South Dakota originally, so I know more about the Lakota story than other tribes. I very much recommend these. Vine Deloria's book, Custer Died for Your Sins, Black Elk Speaks. So John Neidhart had conversations with Black Elk, and Black Elk gave him permission to write them down and to publish them. Burying My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, which is also a film. Many of you may have seen it. If you really want to know about Lincoln in particular, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and the American Slavery by Eric Foner is one source. Of course, there are many other important books about Lincoln. Notes from No Man's Land by Eula Biss. Neither Wolf Nor Dog by Kent Nerburn. And again, that's his conversations with a Lakota elder over a series of months and years, actually, and traveling together. It's also now a film. And finally, Elizabeth alerted me to this collection of poems, Whereas, by Layli Long Soldier. And when we're reading history, as I said yesterday, history matters, and how it's told really matters. I think the more that we can read stories of history from perspectives that are not our own, that are, if we identify as white, if we can read stories about history and the telling of that, by communities of color, those who have really borne the brunt of these policies and these racist policies and such, the more, if we can just kind of set ourselves back a little bit and just really open ourselves to understanding history that's told very differently. Certainly, I didn't get all of this history as a youth. I got some of it, though, from Mrs. Roth, my eighth grade teacher. But I had to learn to fill in some more and to really seek out certain voices that weren't always represented in my school textbooks and things like that. So that's just a bit of then recap from yesterday.
There's a question back there.
Yes, of course, sorry.
I understand that the presentations will be on the Holden website, is that correct?
That is correct.
And will that slide that you just showed be in that presentation?
I'm happy to make all of my slides available to Holden.
I'm sure Sharon could copy that.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Okay.
And you can't see the citations very well, so they'll be on that. It'll be easier to see that as well. Yes, I'm hoping the mic is picking me up for you and for that purpose. So let's just take a breath right now. Since the majority of you were here yesterday, either silently or with another person, introduce yourself if you are able and you feel like talking to somebody. Just take stock for a minute. What was it like to reflect on that history for you? Remember, I asked those questions at the end of class yesterday, and we didn't really talk about the feelings a whole lot, our embodied responses. It got in our heads pretty quick. So let's just take a moment to either journal if you prefer or talk with another person. Yes?
Could you go back to the one slide before? I want to take a picture of all those books that I want to read.
Sorry. I'm going slower, but I'm still going fast, right? Is that the problem? That's what I'm hearing?
I see. Okay.
So take a minute to either write, reflect, talk to another person. Finish your thoughts. interesting slides I showed last time. This is an article from America Magazine. My ancestor owned 41 slaves. What do I owe their descendants? It's from 2018 by John Miller. I did not put this on my resources sheet, so I can pass it around if you want to take a screenshot or whatever. And again, if you want to go into a fuller history about religion and the creation of race and ethnicity, this is these off prints are in the library, but you could also take a screenshot just to remind yourself if you want to look for it at home. So I'll pass these around. And but anybody want to share a little bit about just reviewing that history? We can move up forward, but I'm certainly happy to hear from folks if you'd like to share a little bit about things that surfaced just now as you reflect again.
Reminded me of something that we heard earlier today, where because I feel badly that white people treated minorities this way, we don't have responsibility for that. We're not to feel guilty about that, but we have response-ability to that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good distinction. And I guess what I would say is I love the analogy, and it was so fitting, Michael. You know, none of us were the miners. None of us created the pollution here at Holden Village. But the way that the toxins have seeped into the soil and the water is our responsibility. What are we going to do now? And I really think that is true in this case with regard to race relationships. My family, you know, in fact, I'll tell you, as again, when I started to get my family history, I am half German, half Norwegian, and we settled in Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota. Everybody came after the Civil War, my ancestors. So I will tell you, growing up, I felt this kind of relief of, well, my family didn't own slaves, thank goodness. And then when I told you about the AIM uprising and my dad telling me, well, actually, we live on stolen land, I'm like, oh, no, you know, so... It's important to understand we may have varying relationships to this history, and that's important to tease out, but we are totally responsible for how we live and act and what kinds of bodies we inhabit and what kinds of actions we take. But the good news is there are a lot of constructive paths. And I just want to emphasize again, as I've said other times, white guilt is actually kind of part of white privilege. We can get stuck there and it can feel awful, but it can also remove us from really taking ownership and responsibility. It's a way to kind of insulate ourselves and just wring our hands and feel awful and then get out of doing the hard work.
It's about us.
Yeah, it makes it, we're still the center of attention. So it can be a little bit self-involved. And not helpful. All right, but let's go to helpful territory, shall we?
Yes.
Are we ready to move on?
Yes.
Forward.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, so we're at a crossroads. Where do we go from here, as individuals, as Christians, and as a society? Well, first of all, this is where some of us are going. This is one path we could take. A slim majority, this is just July, just the end of the July, a slim majority of Americans, 51%, believe that President Trump is a racist. This is after the remarks around, if you don't like it, go home, to the congresswomen. And look at the breakdown. 46% of white people said Trump's racist, 50% said he isn't, 80% of black people said Trump's a racist, 11% said he's not, 55% of Latinos said Trump is racist, while 44% said he is not. At 38%, white men are the least likely to say Trump is racist. 58% of that group says he isn't. 53% of white women say he is racist, and 44% do not. So, you might think, well, those folks, they aren't Christians. I don't know what they are, but they're not Christians. Well, take a look at this from Pew. I know, you said, wait, we're going to get constructive. I know. Well, we are going to get constructive. But we first have to understand our options and where a lot of our peers are right now. So, I'm a white mainline Protestant. That's where I'm at. All Protestants taken together, white evangelicals, Catholics, white Catholics, and religiously non-affiliated. And just one more slide on that point from Pew. Sorry, you want me to stay there?
Can you just define for me what white evangelical Protestant means?
So, that's a great question.
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Right, I know.
So, I just want to...
We are part of the, those of us who are Lutheran and ELCA, we are part, so that's a great question, and I'm... The mainline denominations are, and Michael, correct me if I'm messing up, Methodist, Presbyterian, UCC, Lutheran, Episcopalian. Episcopalian. I knew I was forgetting someone. Episcopalian, Reformed.
Small Christian Church.
Disciples of Christ.
Disciples of Christ. Thank you, Janet.
Baptist.
So then evangelicals, white evangelicals are considered non-denominational. Some, right, are have Baptist roots. Is that true? Or is American Baptist mainline?
Mainline.
The people who claim evangelical, it's more important that they're angelical than the denominational roots. Is that fair?
I would assume the people who were in this poll were asked how they...
Yeah, it's how they self-reporting. So, I'm just... that's a great question. Can I maybe think more about it to give you a better answer? But anybody else want to add to that?
Well, just that the name of the ELCA, the word evangelical there, has a very different meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. So we believe that in our title, it's simply that we are proclaiming the good news. That even to, it's
evangelize.
From the, yes, to evangelize, but to proclaim good news to all. So it's not, yeah. So, oh boy, now you know why I did not become a pastor, because I don't know. I'm not ordained, right? I'm a professor. I'm not a church historian, but I should know more. But here, take a look at this. Well, you would think, well, those Christians don't go to church, but actually going to church isn't necessarily helpful in taking a critical look at some of this. So what it says, among white Christians, regular churchgoers approve of Trump's job performance at rates matching or exceeding less frequent attenders. Evangelical Protestant, mainline Protestant, which and white Catholics. What are we hearing in church? Remember when I talked yesterday about how we really have to reckon as white Christians with how much racism really is part of the fabric of our traditions? It's not just an add-on. I don't believe our church is only that at all. I don't believe that we should just say that it's irredeemable, it's racist, and there's nothing... I'm cradle to grave, I'm staying. But I really think we have to reckon with the seriousness, the gravity.
Is it possible that they don't understand what racism means?
Well, yeah, but we're going to get into this now. So what do we make of this? That's a great segue, Cindy. What do we make of these statistics? So understanding ourselves a bit better and unpacking the stages of white identity formation. I'm really relying on Dr. Janet Helms, a psychologist who developed this in 1992. This is the little book that she wrote that's been reprinted in new editions, A Race is a Nice Thing to Have, A Guide to Being a White Person or Understanding the White Persons in Your Life. So I am, again, off-prints of a chapter are in the library. I have an extra copy if you want it, by the way, that someone can just take home. And I'm also drawing a lot on Chapter 3, Raising White Kids by Jennifer Harvey to unpack this. So let me just lay it out for you, and then we're going to discuss it. I guess the first thing I should do, though, is tell you a story, because I've been promising stories. I was in my doctoral program in New York City at Union Theological Seminary, and I was really lucky because I'd landed the job to be the assistant to the seminary pastor, who was the Reverend Dr. Annie Ruth Powell. She was both had a PhD, and she was ordained in the AME Zion tradition. And she was a phenomenal presence on campus, preacher, teacher, and I admired her very much. Unfortunately, while I was working with her as her assistant, she came down with her fourth recurrence of cancer. And so my job description changed dramatically from just helping her with the administrative things of the office to being somewhat of a liaison between her home health needs, or like, you know, people bringing groceries or meals or prayer circles and things, or communicating things to the seminary that were needed and things like that. And I remember one day distinctly, I'm writing my exams at this point in my doctoral program. I'm at that point where I would say I'm on the side of social justice. If you know anything about Union Theological Seminary, right, it kind of draws those types. And I really wanted, I still had in me this desire to be one of the good white people. So anyway, one day I call her from my office to her home, and she, which was all, we lived in a quadrangle, and so you could live close to where you worked. But I called her up, and I was the one in charge of setting the schedule of, like, meals, visits, prayers, errands, you know, who's helping her to get to the doctor if that was needed. And so I called her with a couple of questions on the schedule about who was coming when and what she wanted. And she said to me, Anna, I can't focus on that right now. And, you know, if you knew me better, you would know, my family can testify to this, I am very, like to be on time. I like to be organized. I like to make lists. I like to check off things off my to-do list. And so I said to her, I understand, Reverend Dr. Powell, but if I could just ask you this, this, and this. Anna, I cannot talk right now. And we hung up. And I hung up the phone, and I felt indignant. Like, I am trying to help this person, and I'm doing a darn good job. And, you know, white people are sometimes stereotyped as being super organized. Well, if you've ever seen my office, it's a mess, a disaster, but I'm mentally very organized. And I also like to be efficient. You know, I like to be pragmatic and get things done. And I was just kind of feeling put out a little bit. And I went over to see her later that day. And she called me into her bedroom, and she sat down in the, we sat on the bed together, side by side. And she looked me in the eye, and she said, Anna, I understand that you're trying to help. I understand that you're trying to get the schedule set. But in that moment, your priorities were not my priorities. Mm-hmm. I couldn't breathe then. I was having a real problem catching my breath. And I know you want to organize things. I know you want to nail it down as to who's coming when, but it's going to change. I'm going to tell you one thing in the morning and something else a couple hours later, because that's what's happening. And I don't need you to fix it. I don't need you to solve it. I don't need you to schedule it. I simply need you to listen. And I think she took that risk because we were friends, at least on some level, even though I was her subordinate. And she trusted me at least enough that if she was honest with me, it would matter, it would make a difference. I wouldn't just be the same afterwards. But I have to say that I've lived with that for a long time because my learning, my little epiphany, came at a cost to her health and well-being. She was having a difficult day. And it wasn't just me. She had told me stories of how she would go to the doctor, and if it wasn't her regular doctor, if she had to be hospitalized unexpectedly, and there was staff that she didn't know, they would make assumptions that she didn't have good insurance. They would make assumptions she didn't have much of an education. They would be condescending. They would talk down to her. She would have to continually assert herself as an intelligent person and show that she knew the terminology. And I thought to myself, that is a way heavy extra burden to bear on top of having a very serious form of cancer. When I've gone to the doctor, and thank goodness to this point, I've not had a serious chronic illness, but I have never had to worry about not being taken seriously. I've not been condescended to, and if I have felt somebody's not quite to my liking, I can change without fear of repercussions so far, because I have good insurance. I did my research, as I told some of you, on racial ethnic disparities in health and healthcare, in part because of my experience with Annie Ruth Powell and the impact she made on my life. I interviewed Black and Latino women with breast cancer about quality of care, and one of those women later told me that how no matter how awful she felt because of the chemo, because of other reactions to drugs and things, she would always get dressed up and put on lipstick because she did not want to be seen as somebody on welfare or treated as not intelligent. I have never, ever given thought or concern to how I look when I go to the doctor. Never. So, that's just a bit of a story to illustrate that I thought I was advanced. I thought I was with it, that I had a good sense of self. And actually, that conversation exposed some learning that I needed to do and some growth. So according to Dr. Helms, there are two very different kinds of projects or tasks that people or communities of color are faced with versus white folks. So the task for white folks of color is to resist negative societal messages and develop an empowered sense of self in the face of a racist society. It's again back to what Mark was telling us about W.E.B. Du Bois and developing a double consciousness, not having your self-identity defined by that. Or in Toni Morrison's not just internalizing stereotypes of beauty and needing blue eyes or certain kinds of hair or whatever. white folks, then, our task is to develop a positive white identity based on reality and not on unacknowledged privilege. In other words, we need to have a solid sense of self, but it should not be built on devaluing other people. It doesn't need to be. And in fact, it misshapes us when we do build it that way. So how do we get there? This is the six stages. And I want, and you can take a picture or whatever, and I'm going to write some things on the board about it. What I want to say, though, is a couple of cautions before I talk about each of these. This is not a linear start here, end here. It's not neat. We can jump back and forth throughout our life in these stages. It's messy. Also, this should not be used as a label. These are not fixed identities. We should not say, oh, you're at the reintegration stage. You know, I, however, am at autonomy. You know, so we cannot use it in that way. It doesn't help. And we have to understand that these are simply landmarks. These categories are not fixed or static. Well, since we're at Holden, I can use the word Karen. These are little markers, okay, to help see the path and where we might go and different options for us. So I'm going to write a few things on the board now, and I'll just leave that there. Contact. This is where we all start. This is where the game begins. So in a way, there is a beginning. And that is colorblindness. I don't see race. We are all equal. Racism is a myth. We're in a bubble. I don't see any qualities. As long as you work hard, you try, you're nice to people, you treat others as you want to be treated, it all works out. So this is, when I grew up in South Dakota and I knew no one other than white people, that was pretty much what I assumed. But at some point or another, the bubble bursts. News items. Killing of people by police. Racial unrest. Job discrimination. Some kind of tweet or other. So something disrupts that bubble. And that's when we move to disintegration. Now, disintegration means a crisis. We start to see that race matters, that people are treated differently, that there are different outcomes, and we don't like it. It creates stress for us, moral distress. Now, it can happen. This disintegration can happen when we're children, when we hear racialized things said on the playground, like, ooh, that kid's the color of poop, as my friend's child heard, or no, you can't come over to my house, or no, you can't have a Dorito because you're that color or this color, or all kinds of things that children will say to each other. But it might happen later in life, in college. It could happen even much later in life. Some people said that they didn't, there's one person who had said to my friend Jennifer, I didn't really move out of this until I started to see that Trump was elected and the things that he said, and he could still get elected and say them. Then I realized, whoa, something is going on that I didn't know. So disintegration means a crisis, that our moral framework is shattered. So now we have an important choice. We have three options, according to Helms, and boy, does it matter. The first option is we can go back to contact. It's like going back to jail or do not pass go, collecting $200. It's basically, it's la, 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 la. That's scary. That did not feel good. I don't want to acknowledge it. I don't want to think about it. It's stressful. I'm just going to treat people the way I want to be treated. We're all the same. I'm okay. I can breathe. And you just go back in the bubble as much as possible. The second option is reintegration. Reintegration is, yes, there are problems, but the reason why people aren't treated the same is because people of color are making bad choices. They should have listened to the police. They should have put up their hands. They should have dressed differently. They should have turned down the music. They should have, you know, and I go on and on and on and on. So yeah, there are problems, but it's their fault. And so there's a lot of anger and fear at the level of reintegration. And a lot of And people who are at this stage oftentimes will say, well, yeah, but so-and-so is my friend. There are exceptional people. Oh, you're not like that. You know, that kind of language comes up a lot at the reintegration stage. So then the third option is pseudo-independence. Now, if I erase my trajectory, what I want to convey, if I take the time to do that, is that pseudo-independence takes us to a whole new place. It takes us a little bit out of this loop of contact, disintegration, and reintegration. It takes us to a whole new framework for understanding ourselves. It's jumping to a new island in a way. It's making an important leap in development. Otherwise, we can just keep cycling back among between contact, disintegration, and reintegration for a whole long time and not really get anywhere and feel pretty stuck. So pseudo-independence is finally when we say for the first time and understand something is wrong with society. It's not with these people. There is something systemic, structural, that is messed up. And so we start now to look at the hard effects of white supremacy. But I want to underscore that this stage is also very stressful, and this is where a lot of white guilt can come up. If you've been feeling that this week, you know, shame. Am I racist? Am I doomed to be racist? Am I stuck here? Is this all that I am? Is this what my identity amounts to? So if we stay here too long, we can start to wallow in that white guilt. We feel awful, we feel icky, we don't know how to talk to people, we're so afraid that we're going to say the wrong thing, we're not comfortable in our own skin, and we kind of fall over ourselves, or it just gets too stressful and we retreat even further back. You can always jump back. So the real key is, what do we do with the stress that we feel? How do we handle it and where do we go? Because understanding that we are complicit, this is the first stage where we really get that we are morally complicit, in that we are accountable. So then the problem is, why we can get stuck here is because this stage by itself doesn't give us any strategies. We just feel awful, but we don't know where to go. So the next stage is immersion and emersion. That's where we start to develop strategies. So in this stage, we start to change our relationship to whiteness. We explore it, we challenge it, we change the meaning of it. We start to say, okay, who am I? Let's take a full account of who I am racially, and also, very importantly, who do I want to be? And we start to realize that there are choices before us. There are changes that we can make. And we're going to map these a lot on Friday. The idea is that we start to understand, I don't have to escape my whiteness. I don't have to endlessly apologize for being white. But we do need to understand what it means to be a white person in society. And then we can start to say, I can impact and I can change how racism works in my life. I am not simply a passive observer. I am not simply a victim of fate or social location. I can actually make some interventions in my own life. And then we start to realize at this stage that we need to fight racism not simply for the sake of people of color, and that does matter because people are dying over and over again, and they are losing jobs, and they are facing a lot of chronic stress and having adverse health effects from that chronic stress. Again, black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die either in childbirth or after childbirth due to labor and delivery complications than their white counterparts. Infant mortality rates for black children dying in their first year of life then is at least twice as high as it is for white kids. So yes, there are huge health effects, diabetes, hypertension, etc. But we start to realize in this immersion and immersion stage that our own well-being is at stake here. As Michael said it so well, our own moral character, our own moral viability is at stake. Racism misshapes us. It messes up all of our relationships. It's hard, very hard, to have health in ourselves when we aren't challenging racism. So finally is autonomy. And autonomy is simply the idea internally derived definitions of self, demonstrate positive racial group commitments, and possess the capacity to relinquish racial privilege. We start really, really, really first, we're comfortable, much more comfortable in our own skin, and we're really ready to make some different kinds of commitments. What does that mean? Depends on your spheres of influence. It might have to do with where you send your kids to school. It might have to do with where you go to church. It might have to do with what kind of demonstrations you actually show up to. It might have to do with the kinds of legislation that you'll help support and get out the vote for, or who you might want to elect to office. It might mean that you start to do some white anti-racism trainings and workshops and then become a trainer and a workshop leader. I don't know what the answers are, and again, we'll map them out, but it means that there are commitments and strategies happening. It's not simply the aspiration of, I want more friends of color, or I want to be a better person. It's where we put our bodies, day in and day out. What kind of conversations we're willing to risk with friends, family, coworkers, students, colleagues, church members, on and on and on. So those are the stages that I have wanted to map out with you today. And I guess the next thing I'll just say, this is another way of putting it. Contact, white way is the right way, or everything is fine. The crisis resolves the crisis by going back to contact and blaming people of color. Pseudo-independence is paternalistic. Tolerance of other racial groups. Immersion redefines own identity. And autonomy is really when we're starting to live out different strategies. The capacity to say, you know what, my identity does not depend on this privilege that I didn't earn. An example of the privileges that I have, I've never been asked for my identification when I've used a credit card or written a check in my adult life. I've never been followed around in a store about, you know, shoplifting, even when I was a kid. I was recently stopped for going over the speed limit in Wisconsin, and the officer asked if everything was okay and gave me a warning. It was real chatty. Yeah, I was going, and it was more than 5 miles an hour. I'm not a bad parent. It wasn't, I think it was 35 and I was going 50. So I guess I didn't do good. So I should have gotten a ticket. I almost said, you should give me a ticket. And I thought, what am I thinking? Because I knew it was like $200. But maybe I should have, because I would have relinquished my white privilege in that moment. You know? Actually, really, I want the ticket. I deserve it. Dang it, I missed an opportunity there. Okay. So what I would like you to do now is to map a little bit for yourself. Again, no one's in a fixed place. These are just landmarks, but I'd like you to reflect a little bit on your own life. So first of all, I'd like you to do that for a couple of minutes, if you can, just writing, okay? Just getting some things out in writing. And then I'd like you to share again. But I think it's so important for those of us who are a little more shy about sharing to have a way of sharing just with ourselves. And I also can't stress this enough. If you are like me and you love to talk and you love to share stories, please create space for others to share. Ask questions, let there be silence. I'm still a recovering extrovert, but just try and make space for others to participate. Yes, Janet?
Is there time for a question regarding the Helms?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I'm the one thing, thank you for really reiterating that it's not just linear and it doesn't just progress stage by stage, because the way it was written in the short little excerpt, it sounded more like that.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I'm confused about is the positive white identity, in the sense that we've been talking about in your session, it was also mentioned in Mark and Michael's today, whiteness being created concurrently with the history of white supremacy,
yeah,
as a legal category for discrimination against those who are not white. And so other than a positive identity with other whites as anti-racist allies, I'm not sure what a positive racial identification would be.
Yeah.
On the other hand, while I understood where you were going earlier when you said you'd identified as Norwegian and not as white, I also think there is a place for, like, well, if how can I understand myself as coming from a place or having a
right
immigration?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not saying you can't tell your stories that way. Of course.
Sure.
I still claim that.
So what is what is Holmes trying to get at with positive racial identity?
All right, so would people...
White for white.
I will come to that. I will talk about that. But I'd still rather you just do a little talking yourselves, okay? So hold on. So either write a little bit. If you can, I forgot to bring scratch paper today. Does anybody have paper they could share if you don't? I really messed that up. Or just some reflection. Yeah, these are evaluation forms you're supposed to evaluate in. All right, take a minute to think or write, and then we'll talk, okay? I just really want to give you a space to reflect some way. So I'll time it, and then I'll tell you to start talking to other people when it's time. What do you think of these stages? How do you see them in your own life, in your own communities? Where are you at? Where do you think your family's at? That kind of stuff is what I'm asking you to reflect on. So quiet now for just a minute.
Anna, do you have pens?
I have pencils.
Oh, great.
Does anybody need paper? Is this great? I have paper if anybody would like it.
Can you flip back to some of those stages?
Do you like this one or the shorter one? Okay, Holdenites, take a few minutes, like maybe 5 or 6, to talk with other people about these stages and how you see your life in them, how they're helpful or not, etc. And then we'll come back to Janet's question. I would say groups of 4 would be good, not more than that. Introduce yourselves if you don't know each other.
And that was why my question is impossible.
back. If there's something you really want to ask or say that came up in the group, that's fine. But I think it's important to just kind of take your own pulses on these issues and just kind of do some reflection and realizing, you know, all of this work takes practice. When I'm more engaged in multiracial conversations and work, I do better. But when I start being around a lot of white people, either in classes or family or other engagements or my church, which is predominantly white, and I'm not that doing that kind of engagement, I notice myself regress and be less comfortable and fumble over things that I say and worry about, am I liked, and is it, did I, you know, getting all caught up in myself again. So it's like anything else with muscle and exercise and such, we have to keep practicing. This is another stage, this is another kind of psychological development. Just like our bodies change depending on what we eat, what our nutritional intake is. So without this kind of practice and exercise, we start to lose some of our facility. So it's just an ongoing process.
I have to ask you something.
That's a good question.
And this is something that has been concerning me more and more. The overuse of the word racist, please don't misunderstand me. I mean, people bandy that about so quickly, and it can marginalize a person that has a legitimate question.
Yeah.
Right? And so how do you feel about the use of the word racism and racist as a weapon against people that might have something that they really want to know about and have a legitimate question, and they're not trying to say something that's untoward to another group, a minority group or something?
Certainly, we can use words as slurs of various kinds to shut down conversation. We can, and those words are numerous, but because that, even though that happens and the words are used poorly, does not make me think that we should stop using the word. It makes me think we need to define it, and we need to not just use it as a way to shut down conversation and shut somebody down, but sometimes we need to explain in a careful, thoughtful way why something that was said or done is racist. But now, like, hold on just one sec. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that more tomorrow.
Okay.
That's before the movie. We're going to talk about racism and what it means. But I guess what I want us to say is that it's so easy when we feel the stress and the discomfort to regress and want to go backwards. And my perennial theme this week is trying, as a white person, to invite us, other white people, to be more willing to stay with the discomfort of it. It doesn't feel great if somebody calls you a racist or it says what you said or did is racist. I have experienced those kinds of things when I've said things with good intentions. But you know what? They were also, as Michael put it today, speaking the truth in love, actually, and explain and unpacking for me. And I can tell you a story about that with a teaching colleague where some assumptions that I was making really were messed up. And again, I had great intentions. I wanted to learn. He took the time to educate me, just as Annie Ruth Powell did. It came at a cost to him. But it's important to not shy away from that. So we have to use words carefully and define them, for sure. Same with white supremacy. I don't think we should shy away from it, but I think we need to unpack it. So this is an exercise I thought about maybe doing during the session, and instead it's from the Janet Helms chapter. It's a little bit of inventory that you can do if you wish about kind of some signifiers of where you might be on some of these stages, where you might have work to do. It's for you to take if you wish or not. It's for your own individual reflection if you wish. The other thing that I wanted to give you, and I'm coming back to you, Janet, I haven't forgotten, is that if you haven't yet gotten one of the resources for further reading, viewing, podcast, all that, organizations to connect with, and you're not sure if you can come back tomorrow or the next day, make sure to grab one of these before you go, okay? They're right up here. Do you want me to pass them around? Do most of you have them? Yeah. Most of you have them. If you don't, they're right here. So back to Janet's question. How is it that we can have a healthy or a positive sense of white identity? There is no neat fix. There is no perfect place. Just like whenever you're kind of on the outside of the norm, whenever you are not defined by the standard of humanity, whether it's because of your gender or sexual orientation, your socioeconomic class, whenever your level of abilities, your race, ethnicity, your religion, there's always dis-ease. We're never fully comfortable. And if that's true for people who are at the margins in various times and places, then I think it's fair that white people in our own racial identity live with a bit of dis-ease throughout our lives as well. As long as we live in a racist society, and I do believe that we do, it's also filled with a lot of loving, good-intentioned people, millions and millions of them. But there are structural problems that are racist, and we'll talk about them tomorrow. As long as we live in that kind of a world, then we're never going to be 100% comfortable, and maybe that's because we shouldn't be. But this is what my friend and someone you know as well, Janet, Jennifer Harvey, has written about racial identity and what is a healthy white racial identity. So let me just end today with that. Is that okay? We have like, I think I can finish by 5. It's just a couple of lines. This book is amazing. If you're a parent, grandparent, have children in your life in one way or another, I highly, highly recommend this. So she's speaking about raising children. Healthy white identity does not mean teaching children to embrace their whiteness and celebrate white is beautiful. It does not mean lifting up whiteness as one difference amid a multicultural array of differences. In a society that is structured as a white racial hierarchy in which violence and injustices against people of color are the norm, then such teaching is morally incoherent. Similarly, healthy does not mean pretending that any of us is just human. We can't simply disavow our whiteness and nor pretend that being white does not impact our humanness as part of our effort to disavow racism or challenge racial hierarchy. So, on one hand, aiming for racial health means that we do need to teach white children that they're white. Our children need to be taught that their whiteness does position them in specific ways relative to racism and their relationships with children of color. But on the other hand, healthy does not mean wandering around wrapped with guilt and feeling uncomfortable in our one skin all the time. It does not mean that we believe ourselves responsible for having been born into this inheritance of white supremacy. Nor do we misperceive ourselves as somehow single-handedly responsible as a white savior for ending the crisis of white supremacy for all times or able to accomplish such a thing. Here's how she puts it. We are clear that we cannot downplay the power of racism in our white lives. But we are also clear that racism does not have to have the last word in our white lives either. It's a paradox. So we neither want to be underdetermined by our white racial identity nor overdetermined. But it's constantly in flow. There is nothing fixed or there's no destination. It's a journey. So that's the last slide, is about that journey. Tomorrow we'll look at an example of pervasive structural racism in housing. We'll define racism more carefully. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today.